enthusiasts, and welcome to a special episode of Style Points. The most difficult test that I ever took was the oral board exam for anesthesiology. This test is taken after successful completion of residency and has two 35-minute sessions that assess your judgment, adaptability to unexpected clinical changes, organization, and presentation of information. One of the most difficult parts of the exam was how to study. Personally, I really appreciate examples. However, really good examples of an oral board exam are hard to find. With the permission of the ABA, I've taken one of their example board stems, as well as an official oral board examiner, Dr. Suzanne Bennett, to present the highest fidelity example of what the oral boards is really like. One of my colleagues who recently passed the exam, Dr. Steve Summers, graciously agreed to play the role of the examinee. Without further ado, the mock oral exam. Steve Summers is an assistant professor of anesthesiology at the University of Cincinnati and a good friend of mine. In addition to being a clinically excellent anesthesiologist, he has two beautiful daughters and is quite skilled at smoking meats. He successfully passed his oral boards in October of 2022. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Suzanne Bennett is a professor of anesthesiology at the University of Cincinnati, where she wears many hats, including being medical director of the CVICU and the ECMO program at UC Health, and director of the critical care division at UC Health as well. In her spare time, she administers the ABA oral board exam. Suzanne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When I was studying for my oral boards about 5 years ago, one thing that I always thought was difficult to find was an example of what the oral boards might actually be like. Today, with a real board examiner and the permission of the ABA, we present what the oral board exam is like, followed by some debriefing. One last thing before we start, I do want to mention that Steve is post-call, having worked overnight before we recorded this morning, which is the equivalent of doing this with one hand tied behind his back. I'll start by reading the short stem aloud. A link to the stem will be in the show notes. A 38-year-old, 50-kilogram woman is scheduled for excision of an occipital glioma while in the sitting position. You are first to note a late systolic murmur, loudest at left sternal border. She has mild controlled hypertension. Medications include hydrochlorothiazide for 5 years and dexamethasone for 5 days. Pulse is 74, blood pressure is 135 over 80, respiratory rate is 16, temperature is 37 degrees Celsius, hemoglobin is 13 grams per deciliter, sodium is 140 milliequivalents per liter, and potassium is 2.9 milliequivalents per liter.
Okay, Steve, thank you for coming. We want to make sure that we have the same exam as described in the introduction, a 38-year-old, 50-kilogram woman going for an excision of an occipital glioma.
That's what I have in front of me here. Yep, thank you.
Perfect. We'll get started with the preoperative evaluation. The neurosurgeon asks, what cardiac evaluation is needed for this patient? What would you say?
Well, given her murmur, I think I would certainly want some more information on the nature of any valvulopathy that she might have, especially given the sitting crani and the higher risk of the positioning for that procedure.
What do you mean the higher risk of that sitting position for that procedure? How does that affect your cardiac evaluation?
Well, as opposed to most patients who are supine and the perfusion of the brain is at the level of the heart, there's going to be a discrepancy between what the heart is seeing and what it's delivering to the brain. So I would certainly want to make sure that there isn't some depression in ventricular function or other severe valvular abnormality that I would have to adjust my treatment and monitoring of for.
What is your concern with this late systolic murmur heard at the left sternal border?
So it could certainly be aortic stenosis. It could be pulmonic valve stenosis, such as pulmonic stenosis. It could also be some other intracardiac defect.
And what studies did you want?
Specifically for her, I would order an echocardiogram.
Would you delay the surgery to get the echo?
I would. Given the nature of the positioning, I think it could have a significant impact on how I manage the patient.
Anything else you could get from her history that might reassure you with proceeding without the echo?
Well, certainly. I think that aortic stenosis is probably the most likely thing I would, you know, be asking about any chest pain, shortness of breath, edema, syncope, presyncope, and just other general questions for patients who may or may not be in heart failure.
What about mitral valve prolapse? Could that be what's going on here?
Mitral valve prolapse doesn't tend to have like a late peaking murmur. I think there's more of an opening snap and some regurgitant type of murmur. So I am less likely that that's the case for her, but the echo would help delineate that as well. So
if you got an echo and it does in fact show she has aortic stenosis, would you cancel the case?
No, not necessarily. It sounds like it's a surgery that needs to happen. I mean, certainly if it was like critical aortic stenosis, if there were other abnormalities, then we would certainly have to have a discussion with the neurosurgeon as well as the cardiac team to devise the best strategy. But if it weren't that serious, it may just key me into changing how I monitor the patient and proceed.
What if there were no intracardiac defect? How would that affect your management of this patient?
Well, she's still at risk for hypoperfusing her brain, given the sitting nature. So even without any obvious cardiac dysfunction, I still would need to plan to make sure she has the appropriate access and monitoring to ensure she has a good cerebral perfusion during the case.
Speaking of the cerebral perfusion, how do you determine, let's say, if the intracranial pressure was increased currently, like preoperatively?
So clinically, there are a number of things you can look for. So patients often have a depressed sensorium or altered mental status. They often have a headache. They often have some nausea and vomiting. They can have blurry vision. And as it progresses in severity, you can get cranial nerve deficits as well.
Why would it be important to assess this before surgery?
Because it can impact not only my anesthetic plan as far as improving blood flow to the brain, but the surgeons are also going to want an ideal operating environment, including brain relaxation. So if there were things that could be done preoperatively to set us up in a better position, then certainly would do some of those things.
If you do suspect that the intracranial pressure is elevated, what could you do preoperatively to intervene?
So the patient is already on dexamethasone, which can help with some vasogenic edema. You can also do things such as osmotic diuresis, whether that and included hypertonic saline or mannitol.
Those, which would you choose?
I would probably do mannitol, but either of those would be fine options.
Why did you choose mannitol over hypertonic saline?
I have used it more, just personally speaking, in the operating room, so maybe have a little bit more of a comfort level with that.
How does this hypokalemia, the potassium of 2.9, play into your decision?
Well, she already has some hypokalemia, and certainly giving mannitol could make that worse. It could dump more potassium into her urine, so that's definitely something to consider.
Would you want to treat that before you went to the operating room?
I would, ideally. I would talk to the surgeon. If it didn't sound like it's something that had to go immediately, I would talk about delaying the case to get it to at least a low normal level. One, anticipating that if I were giving an osmotic diuretic, that would drop her potassium even more. Also, I may be hyperventilating the patient during the case to help with brain relaxation and reduction in ICP, and so that could further drive potassium lower. So
the nurse surgeon's like, why do we even care about this low potassium? What impact does that have on the patient?
Well, I would explain to him kind of what I just mentioned to you, and also I think the heart in general is at a higher risk during this case, and if there was hypotension, if there was any air that entered into the heart, I think, if she was more likely to have arrhythmias already at baseline, then that could potentially just further aggravate things.
Would you delay surgery?
I would.
To what endpoint? When would it be okay to go to the operating room?
So I would shoot for low normal, which would be, you know, roughly 3.5.
Certainly, what if she was 3.4?
If it was 3.4, we would probably proceed, and I could also give her more potassium during the case as well. So,
how would you manage the potassium if you had the increased ICP and you had to do the hyperventilation and the diuresis, as you mentioned?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things that I could do. Certainly, you can give potassium faster if you have a central line. So I could give it at about twice the rate as compared to a peripheral IV. I could also potentially have allow some permissive acidemia. Also, I wouldn't go crazy with that, but there was slight metabolic acidosis that would allow the potassium to drift a little higher as well.
What are the implications of hypertension to your anesthetic management?
I think one of the major tenets of neurosurgery is maintaining an adequate oxygen delivery, blood flow to the brain, and there can be problems with both hypertension and hypotension in the setting of a brain tumor. It looks like her baseline blood pressure is 135 over 80, so I would certainly want to make sure that we were close to that level, or making sure that she was taking her medications leading up to surgery. And
well, what if the blood pressure was 180 over 115 preoperatively? How would that affect your decision?
So I would first try to get a sense of, one, if she was having a lot of pain, if she was anxious about going back to the operating room, if she had recently taken her hydrochlorothiazide. I would also want to reassure myself that she wasn't having some sort of, you know, Cushing reflex that...
Would you treat it?
Again, if her blood pressure was, if her baseline was what it is in the stem, and I thought that this was more so anxiety-driven, I would be less likely to treat it to get it right back down to a baseline, knowing that if I treated it preoperatively, I potentially could overshoot when I induce anesthesia and then have hypotension that I would have to...
Well, let's say she didn't take her medications this morning and this blood pressure is 180 over 115. Would you treat it prior to going to the operating room to bring it back down?
Some practitioners would. I would not. I certainly wouldn't give her hydrochlorothiazide. That can make her more hypovolemic and hypokalemic. I would bring her back to the operating room, and I would slowly induce anesthesia to make sure that we were keeping a close eye on her blood pressure and getting closer to her baseline.
We're going to move from the preoperative evaluation into the intraoperative management part of the case. What type of IV access would you use?
I would definitely want large bore IV access for this patient to be able to give fluids quickly. I'm not sure if I would place a central line or not, but that would also depend on if she had any abnormalities on her echo preoperatively as well.
Does the sitting position impact your decision as to whether or not to place only peripheral IVs or to proceed with some central access?
I know that in a lot of textbooks it talks about placing central lines for these cases. I don't think that the literature is clear-cut that there's obvious benefit for that. I think if there was possibility that there would be benefit to placing that and the risk was low enough to placing, then I would probably place a central line.
Well, let's say she does have terrible IV access. You are unable to get the peripheral IVs that you thought were needed for the anesthetic,
sure,
and you have to proceed with a central access. Would you go with the standard central venous catheter? Would you use a pulmonary artery catheter? What would you choose?
I would use a multi-orifice central venous catheter that, one, not only had the ability to give certain medications and fluids safely, but also would give me the best shot at being able to aspirate any air should there be a venous air embolism during the case.
So what would you choose?
The multi-orifice central venous catheter. I for this particular patient, wouldn't place a PA catheter.
So you have her in the operating room and you're proceeding with the right internal jugular cannulation for the central catheter that you mentioned. And as you're doing that, the patient coughs and becomes dyspneic. What's your differential?
Well, my main concern would be that the needle was close to the pleura and that I may have caused a pneumothorax. It's possible that she could also have had injury to the phrenic nerve or be anxious, but obviously would want to rule out a pneumothorax in this situation.
So what would you, how would you do that? How would you rule out or rule in a pneumothorax?
I think the fastest way would be to have someone bring an ultrasound in the room, and I would scan the chest to rule that out.
What are you looking for?
Specifically, I'd be looking for absence of B lines, absence of lung sliding, and lung pulse. And if I did not have those, then I'd be looking for a lung point to kind of pathognomonically confirm a pneumothorax. I would also call the x-ray tech to get a chest x-ray as well.
If the x-ray hasn't arrived and you're confident based on your ultrasound exam that this is a pneumothorax, would you treat that prior to the x-ray?
It depends on the hemodynamic circumstances. If everything was kind of stable and status quo, then I wouldn't immediately need to treat it. If there were there was hemodynamic compromise.
Actually, the blood pressure is dropping precipitously. What would you do?
In that case, that I would need to do a needle decompression.
How would you do that?
So I would use a 16-gauge angiocath placed roughly between the second and third intercostal space on the obviously the side that the pneumothorax was on to allow decompression of the air. I would also be calling for trauma surgeon or whatever surgeon I had in-house to assist with placing a chest tube after that.
What do you think happened there?
Why did
the blood pressure drop?
Oh, well, I think enough air accumulated in the pleural space that led to a reduction in venous return and therefore a decrease in cardiac output.
Well, how do you plan to induce this patient? Let's say you fixed the whole pneumothorax, or maybe the patient never even had one. How would you plan to induce the patient?
So my main goals are to maintain perfusion pressure to the brain. So I would do, assuming that she didn't have terrible reflux or some other reason that I needed to do an RSI, I would slowly induce the patient. I would have an arterial line in place to begin with, and I would monitor the blood pressure closely. I would plan on using propofol. I would also have agents such as esmolol and fentanyl before laryngoscopy just to ensure that I blunted any laryngoscopic refluxes.
Why did you choose propofol?
So propofol is, it's reliable, it's predictable, it blunts refluxes to a certain degree, I think better than, say, etomidate would. And even though it can cause some reduction in blood pressure, it also tends to decrease the cerebral metabolic rate for oxygen, so...
What about lidocaine? What role do you have for lidocaine in this induction?
I know most people give lidocaine. I think that would be fine to give. I don't know that it is particularly effective. If my goal is to avoid sudden tachycardia and hypertension on induction with this patient, I think I would rely more heavily on things such as esmolol and fentanyl.
What about blunting the laryngeal reflexes? Is there a role for lidocaine in that?
I'm not clear cut on the evidence there. I think there's some suggesting that it's beneficial and others suggesting that it's not so much. I do routinely use it, but if I have a real reason that I really wanted to avoid the hypertension and tachycardia, like in this case, then I wouldn't solely rely on it.
What about an opioid? Would you administer an opioid with this induction?
Yeah, I would give a small dose of fentanyl. Again, I would be monitoring the blood pressure the whole time with the sympathectomy that it can cause just to ensure that I wasn't dropping too much.
What about midazolam? Is there any value of midazolam in administration in this patient?
There could be, but I would be very cautious about giving it. If there were concerns about increased ICP, then giving midazolam that could cause respiratory depression. One, you know, could cause hypercarbia, potentially hypoxia that could make the situation worse. And then also, you know, just certain tenets of neuroanesthesia would be to, if at all possible, avoid medications that could confound a neurologic exam.
What about the maintenance? What's your plans for maintenance of anesthesia?
Let's speak with the neurosurgeon just to make sure that there weren't plans for neuromonitoring. I don't believe that occipital tumor resections are, at least from what I'm aware, typically use neuromonitoring that would necessitate a TEVA. If that were the case that they didn't need neuromonitoring, then I would plan on using a volatile agent such as sevoflurane and
how
paralytic.
About nitrous?
I don't think nitrous would be a great choice here.
Is it contraindicated?
It's probably more or less absolutely contraindicated.
Why this. So?
A couple reasons. I think number one would be sitting cranies, I think, are ubiquitously associated with some degree of venous air embolism, whether that's very small amounts or potentially even larger amounts. And then pneumocephalus is another concern for this type of surgery in this position that nitrous would just can make either situation worse.
You mentioned TEVA for neuromonitoring. What neuromonitoring would be in play that you would not use the volatile anesthetic, but you'd use TEVA?
So specifically in the occipital lobe, you have the optic radiations. So if there was a chance that the tumor was pressing on part of that pathway, then visual evoked potentials could have a role. I know that they are very sensitive to the effects of volatile anesthetics. So if the surgeon did have a plan on monitoring for the integrity of those tracts, then I could use a TEVA for that, but otherwise.
Does this surgery require relaxation with neuromuscular blockers?
It doesn't require it. It certainly requires a still field. So if I didn't use neuromuscular blocker, I would need to use something else such as remifentanil to keep the patient still.
What would you use?
I would use a neuromuscular blocking drug such as rocuronium if there was no other neuromonitoring going on.
Why'd you choose rocuronium?
It's predictable. It's relatively short acting.
Well, they're proceeding with surgery now. You've induced, you've got the patient comfortably and safely anesthetized, and the surgeon complains that the dura is taut. What would be your response? How would you treat this?
A couple things I could do. So probably the fastest thing that I could do to help with a situation would be to hyperventilate the patient to a certain degree. You'd also make sure that there aren't excessive levels of PEEP that could cause increased CVP and therefore some venous congestion. Some things that would take a little bit longer would be administration of mannitol, but I'd be talking to the surgeon about all those things.
How much hyperventilation is enough? Like, how do you know you've done enough?
I think low normal is appropriate. So probably be shooting for a PaCO2 in the low 30s. I think that will help with vasoconstriction and reducing the cerebral blood volume and therefore ICP. Any beyond that, any more hyperventilation is likely only going to potentially lead to cerebral ischemia and not have any further effects.
How does it lead to cerebral ischemia?
It's a vasoconstriction response.
Could you deepen the anesthetic? Would that help?
I could, but if I was mainly relying on volatile agents such as sevoflurane, increasing the anesthetic depth there would likely only lead to uncoupling of cerebral blood flow. It can actually cause excessive vasodilation, so I could actually make the situation worse.
You mentioned osmotic diuresis or mannitol. How much would you give?
I am familiar with giving doses in like the half a gram per kilogram range for patients. So I would obviously discuss with the surgeon, you know, if they had a preference on how much to give, but it would be somewhere in that ballpark.
Is there a maximum dose where you would just not give any more?
I don't know that there is an actual maximum dose. I think theoretically, if you kept giving it, then you would run into issues with hypovolemia and electrolyte derangements.
What about deliberate hypotension? Would that be beneficial to help with to decrease the intracranial pressure?
Theoretically, it could help decrease the intracranial pressure. However, it would be highly likely that I could be inducing ischemia to the brain, either globally or to the area of interest that the tumor where they're working on. So I would be very hesitant to deliberately induce hypotension. I could decrease the blood pressure within a certain range compared to the patient's baseline.
How low would you go?
Assuming that her blood pressure, her baseline was what it is in the stem, you could drop it 15-20%.
How would you do that?
Well, assuming that I had an appropriate depth of anesthetic, I would use, there's a couple different options. There's direct vasodilators. Nicardipine would be a good option for something short-acting and predictable. It's probably what I would reach for first.
Well, there's a sudden blood pressure decrease. It drops to like 50 over 35. What do you think could be going on?
There's a number of things. My main concern would be that there could be a venous air embolism. If we had caused a pneumothorax earlier with central line placement, that there could be some kind of a delayed presentation in tension physiology there. You could have excessive anesthetic on board or accidental administration of a vasodilator, but certainly would want to rule out venous air embolism in the first place.
How does that work? How does this venous air embolism create hypotension?
When air entrains and enters into the right heart, it goes through the pulmonary tree, and if there is enough air, it can actually cause an obstructive shock type of picture in the right ventricle and the right ventricular outflow tract.
How could you establish the diagnosis of a venous air embolism?
So I know this wasn't brought up, but I would, for this case, probably would have placed a TEE probe to monitor for that, and that would be the fastest and probably the most sensitive way to detect air entering the heart. If I didn't have that, could call for a precordial Doppler to get that in the room, but I would also be looking for other signs such as a decrease in end tidal CO2. Obviously, the patient's hypotensive. You could be hypoxic at some point since you're not delivering blood flow through the pulmonary tree.
How would you, let's assume it is an air embolism. Your suspicion is quite high. How would you manage it?
I would first notify the surgeon, make sure that they had flooded the field with saline to stop any further air entry. I would be treating the blood pressure with one fluids and then inotropes. I think epinephrine would be a great choice in this case, not only to help raise the blood pressure, but also to support the right ventricle. If I had that central venous catheter in place, I would be attempting to aspirate air from that. And then I would also be talking to the surgeon if it would be appropriate to drop the head of the bed, place them in more of a left side down, just to try to move air away from the RVOT.
So, you know, this patient, you suspect, has a venous air embolism. Why with this particular surgery, is there a greater risk in cranial operations as opposed to other surgeries that are prone?
Prone surgery. Well, there are cerebral venous sinuses that can be quite large, that are fairly non-compressible compared to other sites, and there can be multiple of them. So that's kind of my understanding of why it can be particularly problematic for these type of surgeries.
What type of fluid would you be using for the anesthetic?
I would probably use normal saline, given that I wouldn't be administering large amounts that could cause a metabolic acidosis, but the relatively hypertonic nature of it would possibly have some benefit of decreasing brain water content during the case compared to, say, like lactated ringers or something else that would be hypotonic.
Is there any value of dextrose to be added to the IV fluids?
Not that I know of. I certainly would want to avoid Well, obviously hypoglycemia, but hyperglycemia is also detrimental in general, but definitely in neurosurgery as well. So I would not use dextrose unless the patient were hypoglycemic.
Why is hyperglycemia particularly concerning in neurosurgical procedures?
I think it exacerbates the metabolic milieu whenever there is ischemia, retraction injury to the brain. Hyperglycemia is known to make the metabolic situation worse there in the brain.
How would you know how much fluid to give the patient?
There's a number of things that I would be looking for. Certainly vital signs, heart rate, blood pressure. I'd be looking at urine output, skin turgor, mucous membranes. And then there's a number of lab indicators that I would look at, such as the hemoglobin, hematocrit, lactate, base deficit. All those kind of clue me in.
So you have that data. What would tell you you are adequately resuscitated from those findings?
Just numbers that all kind of correlate with what I would expect for that case at that particular point in time. I'm not sure if more specifically beyond that.
We're going to stop there. That's the end of that case. Take a deep breath, drink of water. We're going to move on to totally different cases now. So just forget that case. You've went home, okay. Came back the next day.
Perfect.
All right. First one is you have a 34-week gestation newborn, 2.5 newborn, who shows up for a TE fistula repair. What are the major anesthetic risks for a patient with a TE fistula?
So aspiration is a big concern. Also, difficulty with placing the ET tube and getting it in the correct location. Those are some of the bigger concerns. I know that patients with TE fistula also tend to have a fairly high incidence of congenital cardiac abnormalities. So looking into that as well.
Does the type of fistula alter your approach to management?
There may be some nuances in what I would do differently. I think the tenets are mostly the same.
What about, let's say this child actually has the H-type fistula. What does that mean for you and your anesthetic management?
So the H-type is both I think proximal and distal TE fistula. Again, there's risk of, one, aspiration of any secretions that were in the esophagus or stomach and, causing pneumonia. There's also the risk, and this goes for most TE fistulas, would be air entering the stomach through the lungs and causing difficulty with ventilation.
Would this type of fistula impact your pre-anesthetic plan?
I'm not sure. Beyond cardiac workup and ensuring that there weren't any, that there wasn't like a pre-existing pneumonia that needed to be treated before heading to the operating room, I'm not sure.
What cardiac workup would you want?
I would get an echocardiogram for this patient just to make sure that there weren't any cardiac defects that needed to be addressed prior to heading to the OR.
How would you induce anesthesia for this patient?
Assuming that I had a working IV, since the patient's already going to be an inpatient, I imagine, I would plan on doing an RSI for this patient. I could do an inhaled induction, but I'd probably choose an RSI for this patient.
Why'd you choose RSI?
The risk of aspiration is fairly high. I would, certainly would ensure that the patient had an NG tube a tube into the enteric pouch, the esophageal pouch there, just to decrease the risk of aspiration. But nonetheless, there's still a risk of aspiration. So I would, assuming that the airway weren't planned on being difficult, I would want to get the breathing tube in as soon as possible.
What would you use for induction?
I would use, assuming stable hemodynamics, I would use propofol and rocuronium.
Would a circle system be appropriate?
The circle system, I believe, is what most modern anesthesia breathing circuits are, as opposed to some of the more open air ones. So, yeah, I think a circle system would be appropriate for this patient.
Would you plan to extubate this patient at the conclusion of surgery?
It would be a discussion between us and the surgical team. Given the nature of kind of more delicate operation with fixing the fistula, it may be wise to take the patient back to the operating room and have a more controlled environment for slowly waking the patient up.
Which would you do? Extubate immediately postoperatively or delay that and come back for extubation in the operating room another day?
If the surgeons were happy with, you know, how they ligated the fistula and didn't have any other major concerns as far as, you know, a delicate anastomosis, and if the patient were appropriate otherwise from a blood gas and hemodynamic and metabolic standpoint, I would probably elect to extubate the patient in the operating room, knowing that leaving a breathing tube in for a prolonged period of time, you know, can further compromise lungs that may already be compromised from.
We're going to move from that patient to a new patient, and it's a healthy 25-year-old man who requests an epidural anesthetic for repair of the inguinal hernia. This is an outpatient procedure. Would you agree with the plan?
Not immediately. I would first want to ascertain why he had a preference for that, see if he had particular objections to doing, say, general anesthesia, which is what I would most likely choose for a healthy 25-year-old having that type of surgery.
What are your concerns about the epidural anesthetic versus the general anesthetic?
One would be that, you know, there could be an inadequate surgical level of, you know, blockade to have the do the surgery itself that might necessitate converting to general anesthesia. Also, you know, there's fairly minimal risks, but there's, you know, always a risk of postdural puncture headache, or I mean, I'm sorry, just a dural puncture. And then also, it's not likely, but there is at least some degree of risk of causing some neurologic damage from, say, a hematoma formation.
If you choose the epidural, what drugs would you use for it, assuming it's used for your surgical anesthesia?
I would just rely on a local anesthetic, such as ropivacaine or bupivacaine. I would put a small dose of fentanyl in there, but I wouldn't use anything long-acting like morphine that could cause delayed respiratory depression.
Why did you choose ropivacaine? Could you use bupivacaine?
I could. I think either would be fine.
Are there any reasons to choose lidocaine, let's say, over ropivacaine?
Lidocaine would be have a faster onset. It would be shorter duration, but yeah, I mean, it could lead to a surgical block faster than ropivacaine, so that may be advantageous as well.
Assume you did do the epidural for your anesthetic. What would be the criteria for discharge home?
I would want to make sure that the level had regressed, that the patient had return of neurologic function and had the ability to avoid. And beyond that, it would just be kind of the standard things I'd be looking for discharging a patient from that setting.
Let's assume the patient had a dural puncture that you witnessed when you did the epidural. You were confident you got CSF. How would you manage that in that scenario?
If he was a straightforward placement, I would probably go to a different level and attempt epidural placement again. If it was a particularly challenging placement, then I may thread the catheter and just carefully dose as an intrathecal catheter.
Would you admit the patient?
No, I don't think so. I would counsel and educate the patient on the possibility of postural puncture headache, give them instructions about adequate hydration, maybe some over-the-counter things, and also give them like a phone number to follow up.
What, if any, value would there be to a prophylactic blood patch?
I don't think that that's something that is generally done. I would probably go the more conservative route and give him a number to call back and follow up should he have a classic headache that would be amenable to a blood patch maybe a couple days later.
What would be the problem with doing a blood patch prophylactically? What are the risks?
Well, there's risks that there could be contamination. So you, sterilely draw the patient's own blood and then inject it into the epidural space. So, infection would certainly be a risk.
We're going to stop there and move to the next patient. You're called urgently to radiology, where you find a 25-year-old woman undergoing an arteriogram for upper extremity ischemia. She's hypotensive with urticaria, stridor, and sternal retractions. What would you do?
So it sounds like she may be having an anaphylactic reaction, most likely due to the contrast dye. I would first, ABCs, of course, I would want to ensure airway patency. Things I could do to help with that would be epinephrine is fast acting. I would also, once I had, ensured that she had airway patency, would be giving her bronchodilators as well. If she had any hemodynamic changes, hypotension and whatnot, I'd be treating that with fluids. And obviously the epinephrine would help with that as well.
What if the patient proceeded to have a cardiac arrest? What would you do?
In that situation, I'd be following kind of standard ACLS protocol. In that situation, I would want to secure the airway. That way I could control ventilation. I would be obviously calling for help and initiating chest compressions, having the crash cart in the room.
We'll stop there. We're at the conclusion of the exam.
All right.
Excellent job, Steve.
Was it? Okay. I'm glad you think so.
I think so. I chose you to help out with this because when we were practicing together for your real oral exam, I was always really impressed with your composure and the way that you delivered things. But my opinion doesn't really matter here. I'm not an oral board examiner. Suzanne, what do you think?
I think, whenever I'm doing practice exams with people, I often ask them how they think they did. So how do you feel?
I feel like there were a lot of ums in there. I don't think that I made the best eye contact that I could have the whole time. I think I had overall pretty good answers, but it didn't come out as fluid as I would have hoped. But I feel like if I was betting whether I would have passed or failed, I think I got enough of the important information that you were hopefully seeking.
Yeah. I agree with everything you just said. When we go through the exam with candidates, we're looking for people to show that they are, we go through and check each section as we're going through questions just to see how they covered all of the questions and if they did it adequately. And then after we go through each of the sections, noting, did they hit every question fairly on point? And make appropriate safe decisions. After we review all that, then we go and assess whether the candidate had the appropriate application, adaptability, judgment, and organizational presentation style when they're going through their responses to the questions that we're doing. This is probably the most important aspect of it. It's not really a knowledge-based test. It's a test that we're looking to make sure that the candidate will be able to function safely and practically in the clinical arena doing anesthesia. And the components that I just mentioned, again, I'll say them again, application, adaptability, judgment, and then how did you organize and present yourself during the exam is kind of the major components that we're looking to see that the candidate's hitting effectively. And By application, we're talking about, you know, how do they analyze the clinical scenario, synthesizing factual knowledge, adaptability. We're looking at how do you apply the information that I've given you to the patient that we're speaking to. And then when the scenario changes, how are you adapting to those changes? And, of course, judgment. Judgment is judgment, right? You know, it's did you display safe approaches to the questions that we're asking related to the patient? And did you choose the appropriate managements? And then finally, important, but maybe not as important for the practice of anesthesia, but important in that was the presentation clear, organized? Did you provide adequate information? What I mean by that, it's hard to grade someone who doesn't have the answers to the questions. So if I ask a question and there's a deference or an I don't know, and we continue through the exam like that, I'm unable to grade the three other prior things adequately. So that's definitely a challenge. The areas that you know, I thought you did well is that you were able to adapt to the different scenarios that I presented. Often when I'm examining, I may choose, if I notice that a candidate is struggling with a topic, I try to change my approach to guide the candidate into the right way. Sometimes it could be how I'm asking the question versus and how the candidate's interpreting it versus does the candidate just simply not know? And our goal is to really elicit as the maximum knowledge that we can get out of you. We are assuming you have it, and we want to make sure that we're testing you on the what we think you know so that you can practice safely.
Sure. That all makes sense. Do you have any particular feedback about one section or another, questions that you think I didn't navigate particularly well?
You know, let's just go through it. So from the preoperative evaluation section, you know, we jumped into cardiac and increased intracranial pressure and hypokalemia and hypertension. I think, you know, you hit all of it appropriately. I think if I provided feedback as to maybe areas that you could have probably swung the bat a little bit harder, let's say, is the discussion of blood pressure when we went through the hypertension component. I think providing just a very deliberate answer as opposed to kind of working around the answers. And that's one of the struggles that I think candidates have is when we're asking questions, we want the answer. And then provide the support for that. The trick, though, for the candidate is that if you're providing the support for it, it opens the door for me to ask questions about that. Why yeah. You ask that?
Absolutely.
We will ask why multiple times because we really want to understand why you're choosing that. You know, why is that important? We really want to know what you know. Going to the next section, I think perhaps a little more deeper discussion on how the sitting position and the risk of air embolism plays into this. And you had mentioned you'd place a TEE for the once we got down to air embolism, noting that in advance. Of course, I would have probably challenged you a little bit on that because it's a crani. And a TEE and you all at the head of the bed may be challenging. I think perhaps maybe speaking a little bit more to POCUS and what opportunities that provides to us now in the operating room for sure. An air embolism could have been another way to divert that. And that's probably what I would have done if you would have introduced TEE sooner.
Sure, sure. It's interesting. When I was preparing for my oral boards, a couple years ago, all the things that you really want to focus on, like not dancing around the question, getting the answer out, displaying that you have made your decision, then when you get to the real thing and you hear the words that are coming out of your mouth, sometimes you you immediately know that that wasn't exactly how you wish you would have said it, but you can't take those words back. And all you can do is hope that it leads you to the right place and then see where the examiner is going to go with that. And there were a couple situations where, you know, I think with the mannitol and the hypokalemia, when you kind of brought that up, I was like, ooh, did I make the wrong decision? Should I have chosen hypertonic saline? Because it may not lead to, you know, further exacerbation and hypokalemia, but I can't take it back. And all I can do now is just adapt and move forward and have a short memory and go with it. So,
yeah, you know, it's candidates need to know that we want them to pass. Like we want you to pass. We want you to be successful. And so I call it a dance, and it's a dance. As I'm seeing the candidate going in one direction or the other, I will try to navigate how I'm asking questions to either, if I think it's a comfort level, I'll try to change and adapt to increase the comfort of the candidate, because what we really want to know is we don't want to know how good you are at exams, right? We want to know that you're going to be able to practice anesthesia safely.
Yeah.
And the only way to do that is for us to adjust as we're seeing how you're navigating the exam. And that's what we do.
Sure.
We'll kind of swing a little bit one way or the other, recognizing, and I could feel in times during the exam when you were heading down a path, and I would stop questioning much further on that because I didn't want to get you in a brain lock situation where you're unable to answer further questions.
It's very kind of you.
Well, again, I think it's the goal of us is we want to get through this exam. We need to get through all of the questions that we have available to us. We only have 35 minutes to do it, and it's a hard stop, 35 minutes. And each section, you know, the first section is 10, the second section is 15, and the last section is 10. And we have to, you know, to administer a fair exam for each candidate that comes in, we need to be able to get through each of those questions. Or conceptually the content or in the intent behind the questions. And so we don't want you, the candidate, to get, you know, I call it brain locked, where you freeze up and now you can't move forward because you're so stuck in maybe a mistake you made.
Right.
And so our goal is to try to get you moving forward and give you some other questions to kind of boost that confidence back up and then kind of circle back just to ensure that we're you're able to answer the question appropriately.
Makes sense.
As a candidate, if you feel that your answer was not correct and you really want to change that, you can. You can change that. We're going to ask why. There'll be a lot of whys, but it's not a game of no take back, you know. There's take backs
until the final buzzer goes off.
Until the final buzzer goes off, right? Yes.
One of the things that I think really struck me preparing for my oral boards is how stark of a contrast it is compared to almost every other test we've ever taken before. Going through medical education, almost every single test is multiple choice. Written tests, staring at a computer screen. Here I'm staring across at someone who is, in a way, deciding my future. There's the immediacy of they ask a question and I have to give that feedback right now and I have to get it out in a succinct, efficient, organized manner. I can't come back to question two after I've done question 100. And there's other things at play that really are different than the written exam. So in this situation, it's almost advantageous to make assumptions such as if the airway, assuming that the airway were not intended to be difficult, yes, I would proceed with an RSI. Whereas in written tests, you can only take the information that's presented to you and you should not make assumptions. So there's just key differences that you really have to kind of forget the written multiple choice test and just gear up for in person, in the moment. And that's why you have to practice in your mind with your responses.
How many practice exams do you think you did prior to your oral board exam?
I officially, with different attendings in our department, I did 8. One was with you. And that's one of the only reasons I agreed to do this today is because I knew that you wouldn't kill me. But I did some more informal practice ones with another co-resident of mine from residency. But I would say, you know, each and every one of those mocks, I learned something different. And Dr. Crow, I did one with you. Almost forgot that as well.
Of course.
Everyone's style of questioning is different. Their pace, the way that they look at you, and the level of comfort that you feel in their room. So I think every single one of those is beneficial. And everyone else told me, you need to practice. In my head, I was like, but can't I just go through the book, the prep book, and answer questions in my head and I'll be good? And I would say, yes, you need to do that, but it's invaluable to have that in person. Sure, you can do it over, you know, Skype or FaceTime if you really wanted to or needed to, but I think in-person practice with multiple different people, in my mind anyways, is the key to feeling more comfortable and prepared for the real thing.
Yeah. You know, practicing with people you know places you in a vulnerable position because that other than time, I think vulnerability to colleagues or peers for fear that your lack of knowledge or your response is not what it should be probably limits people from practicing as much as they would.
I can see that.
And I, you know, if people can get past that and just look at some practical things, like you've paid a lot of money and you spent a lot of years in training. This is probably that one time just to throw your vulnerability out the window and expose yourself, because the more failures you have prior to the exam sets you up for your success during the exam, because we learn so much from our failures, right? And when you're failing in a comfortable place with peers and colleagues, you know, it's like a hug, right? When you fail at the boards, you walk out, you've lost all the money and you've got months or a year before you can take it again. Yeah. And so time and money and are really important. While vulnerability is important as well in this scenario, I would just say to people to let go of that just a bit and fail. You know, fail over and over again, because your greatest success will come from those failures. The other thing that I think is important for people to know is that when I took my oral boards, we were still in hotels. We don't have to go back to years and dates. I don't actually feel old, but as I speak, it seems so. I was doing my critical care fellowship. I took it on a Friday morning at 7 a.m., and left there, had a hoodie on, I was in New York, sat at the airport and not at my gate where my plane was going to take off. Other people were celebrating, you know, having drinks at the bar. I'm at the airport taking the earliest flight home, and I've got my hoodie up. I'm crying because I knew I failed. alone, aww. You know. And then, you know, got off the plane in Cincinnati, drove straight to the ICU, and did afternoon rounds with Dr. Friedrich, who was my attending in the unit, and Dr. Mecklen was my resident, and Dr. Pena was also as well, did my afternoon rounds so I could take call all weekend. It was really super awesome. You know, Dr. Friedrich said, "Oh, you did fine, buddy," and then just, you know. Congrats, you're done. And then we made rounds. And what was really super cool is my team had created a little welcome gift that was really comical upon my arrival, which I still keep on my desk in my office.
And you passed.
And I passed. Right.
Yeah. Okay. I thought you were going to leave that piece of information out.
No. I was like, oh my gosh, I passed. But yes, I think it's common. What's the point of the story here is it's common for everybody to feel anyway, but even as worse as you failed.
Sure.
Because you will start cycling through, oh, man, I should answer this. Oh, man, I should answer that.
Yeah.
I still remember personally several examples of questions that they asked me. It really is a situation where their questions and your responses get locked in your brain sort of permanently.
Yes. Yes, they do. They do. I mean, I remember exactly that even today. Like the, and my examiners actually.
Yeah.
So, and my stems. Yes. So,
well, any more specific feedback that you have for Steve on the stem there? Was no. there anything that
No, I think, you know, in all exams, there's areas that people won't know everything. They just won't. But as long as you are practicing safely, that's important. And when you look at, you know, if we go through the last three topics, you know, sometimes we can identify whether someone's a pediatric anesthesia-trained person. Sure. Or if they're a pain person or if they're critical care, it seems to kind of bubble up as we're examining people. Overall, I think you did really well.
Well, thank you.
All right. Steve, Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, John.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us for our special mock oral exam podcast. If this was helpful to your oral board studying, please drop me a line. You can find me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a rating or a review. As always, thanks for listening. Take a deep breath, open your eyes, we're all done.